Father Ciprian for being willing to still come. I thought we would have a much bigger crowd, but because of everything happening, we're really looking forward to being with you.
Glad to be here. Thank you. When Amber asked me to come, she mentioned your theme of pilgrimage that you're doing through the Lenten season. And I just happened to have this new book published called Hermit, Preacher, Wanderer. And the reason for that book was because I spent 10 years living away from the monastery. We had a little hermitage up in Santa Cruz. But I was doing lots of work in interreligious dialogue, which took me to travel all over the world, both teaching and singing and studying. And that book, I brought some copies of it there if you'd like to purchase one, is kind of about 20 of the songs were written during that period, and also the stories behind the songs. A lot of the texts are drawn from different traditions, so explain something about the tradition from which it came, where I first learned the song, where I first sang the song, excerpts from the travelogues and things like that. So it turned out to be a really fun exercise for me, and I thought I'd share some of that with you tonight from my own experience as a pilgrim. That being said, several of the songs I want to sing for you are actually not in that collection, but they're songs that I've been wanting to sing for a while. I don't get to perform very often anymore because I now have a full-time job as the prior of the Hermitage in Big Sur. So I was just telling the folks that I was supposed to go to Texas and Arizona next week. That's getting canceled for travel-wise. So this is my last gig, you know, for the season. But I've learned this new song this past year from someone who's considered kind of a musician's musician, a legendary songwriter named Bruce Coburn, a Canadian singer-songwriter. And I want to sing it for you. It's called 40 Years in the Wilderness. He's now living in the Bay Area, I'm told, and he started out kind of a contemporary Christian singer back in the 70s, and I'm told has kind of come back to the faith again recently. But he's been, a wonderful singer-songwriter, kind of a prophetic voice for many years. Projected and reflected from the greatest and the least. 40 years of days and nights, angels hovering near, kept me moving forward though the way was far from clear. They said, take up your load, run south to the road, turn to the setting sun. Sun going down, gotta cover some ground before everything comes undone. Take up the load, run south to the road, turn to the setting sun. Sun going down, gotta cover some ground before everything comes undone, comes undone. 40 years in the wilderness, dancing with the flies, dazzled by the visions rolling out before my eyes. Angel made graffiti, demons in disguise. You can trade away your birthright for another day's supplies. You could take up the load, run south to the road, turn to the setting sun. Sun going down, gotta cover some ground before everything comes undone. Take up your load, run south to the road, turn to the setting sun. Sun going down, gotta cover some ground before everything comes undone, comes undone. Rising with the height of land, falling with the crowd. Spirits in scouring wind called my name out loud. that said you could go to heaven, or you could go to hell, or you could hang out in the place you know so well, or you could take up the load, run south to the road, turn to the setting sun. Sun going down, gotta cover some ground before everything comes undone. Take up your load, run south to the road, turn to the setting sun. Sun going down, gotta cover some ground before everything comes undone, comes undone. Isn't that a nice song?
Very nice.
The image of the desert. I think like no other season, I don't know if you speak of it this way also in your tradition, like no other season we talk about the Lenten journey in quite often in Catholicism, because of course the resonance of the 40 years in the wilderness of the Hebrew people, and we generally read in the monastic tradition anyway, quite a bit of the book of Exodus that are what you would call matins and vigils in the early morning, and culminating, of course, in the story of the crossing of the Red Sea at the Easter Vigil. And then, of course, in the 40 days of Moses up on the mountain, and then Jesus' own 40 days in the desert. And for us, especially with the renewal of the liturgy after the Second Vatican Council, we have such an emphasis now in our liturgical tradition on Easter and baptism. So this is a journey. We have the catechumenate of people now preparing for baptism, which is really pretty new for us. Again, something brought back from the ancient tradition. So there really is a journey. Watching people prepare for baptism becomes a journey for the whole parish, for the whole congregation to follow the steps. And it's quite a renewal. And we tend to preach that way all through Lent, of our own renewal of our own baptism. What is this journey of Lent? What are we dying to? What are we stripping off in order to renew our own baptismal vows? As I mentioned, I had 10 years of living on my own doing this amazing wandering. The name of this book, Hermit Preacher Wanderer, are the three poles upon which I built my life for those 10 years after my formation and solemn vows and ordination at the monastery. Having studied a lot of the works of Bede Griffiths, who was a English Benedictine monk who spent the end of his life, last half of his life, pretty much in India, one of the co-founders of our ashram there in South India. He and his predecessor, his name was Abhishiktananda, a French Benedictine monk. His original name was Henri Lasseau. He took the Sanskrit name Abhishiktananda. They had this image of a new way that a Christian could be a monk. And they were basing it on the sannyasa tradition of India. In classical Brahmin life, this is mainly applies to that caste system. It mainly applies to Brahmin men, though it's dissolved a little bit now in modern times. There are four stages of life. In the first stage is brahmacharya. You're studying the ways of God. It implies celibacy. It implies, you know, young people who are, you know, very strictly divided by gender, but also studying all the rites and the rituals and the myths and the hymns. And after that, you are really supposed to be, they call it a grihastha, a householder. You should make a lot of money. You should be successful. You should take care of your parents. You should have children. You should be a great success. No shame in that at all. And then, of course, you're following all the rituals and all the sacrifices and the dictates of your religion and of your caste. A little bit later in life, what we would generally think of as the RV stage in life is when you and your spouse could retire to the forest. And it's called vanaprastha. Vana is forest. You could be forest dwellers. So you can dedicate more of your life to the spiritual life, more to the ways of prayer and to meditation. And then there's this mysterious fourth phase of life called sannyasa. And sannyasa means renunciation. In the classical form, which is very seldom lived anymore, I must say it that way, it means that you do the sacrifices for the last time, you sing the hymns for the last time, and then with the instruction of your guru, you go into that river, sacred river, either the Kaveri in the south or the Ganges in the north. You strip off all your clothes, you cut off the sacred string, you cut off the sacred tuft of hair, you come out naked, you get clothed in orange, in Kaveri color, which is the color of the fire of renunciation. And from there on out, you're not supposed to really do any of the hymns or sacrifices or rituals. You're just supposed to meditate. Just make this journey within to the what's called the guha, to the cave of the heart. And you're not supposed to stay anywhere for more than a couple of days. That's the classical strict tradition, which very few people follow anymore. Though there are still many wanderers in India. Some of them are just clothed in orange so they can get free handouts, I must admit. But, I mean, Indians in the holy places in India still see many, many, many of them. And you are not supposed to stay anywhere for more than a couple of days. But sometimes ashrams get built around these renunces, these sannyasis. Most of them are much more domesticated. Most monks in India, in the Hindu tradition, are more domesticated. I remember one monk there told me, see, we have watches and we have college degrees just like you do. And they tend to be teachers. But Father Bede and Abhishektananda both were quite enamored with this classical style of being monk and wanted to adapt it for the Christian monks and thought that a Christian monk, a Christian sannyasi, could be a contemplative, a preacher, as in a teacher, and a wanderer, to put those three together. Hence the name of this book. And I just changed the contemplative to hermit because I come from a hermit tradition. Hermit, preacher, wanderer. And the preaching part of it came more with my own priesthood because I was called upon to teach and preach quite a bit, offer retreats. The wanderer I associated with the musician because I had the guitar and I was called upon quite often to go and do these wonderful, mainly interfaith events. So this is my background. When we talk about pilgrimage, I was 10 years pretty much on pilgrimage with a backpack. I wanted to sing these two songs for you that are kind of relatively new in my own repertoire. After those 10 years, I got bumped upstairs. That's how you domesticate somebody, is to promote them, you know. And I was asked to be prior down at our hermitage. So from wandering around with a backpack and a guitar to a $1.5 million budget, 900 acres and a staff of 15, you know, it's quite, my head is still spinning 7 years later. But after 6 years, I got a sabbatical and I was on the road for 3 months last summer, which was just amazing. And I want to tell you this story. For a quiet life, having such a large staff and such a big property, I do a lot of administrative work, you know, much more than I thought I could handle. But, I mean, I don't mean to be complaining about it, but it's a bit of a burden for somebody who's not really a detail person. Answering emails, answering phone calls, letters, and this one's got to go to the doctor, and what car should we take for that? You know, all the way down from the little stuff to the big stuff, plus, you know, teaching about monastic history and mysticism. So the first morning of my sabbatical, I had finished everything the night before, answered the last email, put my away messages on, put an away message on my phone, packed my bags. I got up at 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning, sat down for a cup of tea. And I had nothing to do. And the silence of that hit me like a wall. Just that. And I had 3 months ahead of me with nothing really I had to do. To feel that spirit of pilgrimage again come in. I had the same car I have today. I had a little Prius and I had a carton of things. I had my guitar. I was on my way to Italy for part of the time and I was going to be traveling through the desert for the rest of it. About 3 weeks of it in solitude, some weeks in Italy and then some weeks with my family. And one of my first stops was at Tassajara, the Zen Mountain Center. It was kind of a pre-sabbatical moment where I was giving a retreat with the former abbot of Zen Center San Francisco on common practice between Christians and Buddhists. It was a wonderful week, and I didn't have to hardly do anything. You know, talk for 5 minutes, and then I let him talk, and maybe sing a song every now and then, you know, soak in the hot tub and eat delicious vegetarian food and meditate. And they paid me for it, you know. But this poem came up of Antonio Machado. that I had heard quoted several times in the past couple of years, one place from David White, the poet David White, and I thought it'd be really applicable to you. And when we were talking about the nature of vocation, the nature of our calling, and there's something very mysterious I've found about the nature of our calling, and it goes along with this idea of pilgrimage. I find that I have not had the typical vocational path that most monks and priests have. I came into the monastery at 34, and they thought that was a late vocation. You know, I didn't get ordained priest till I was 40, and they thought that was a late vocation. I had, you know, a background as a rock and roll musician for some time, and had this and this, that background. And then after being there 10 years, I went out on my own for another 10 years. This vocation just keeps unfolding at itself. In Italian, they call it a cammino. Your vocation, cammino, your journey of vocation, and how it keeps unfolding, and how our life keeps unfolding. And I had this image, especially when I started those 10 years on my own, and I was walking down a hallway, and there were all these doors, and I'd push on the door, and if it didn't open, I'd keep going. And if it opened, I would look inside. If it looked attractive, I'd walk in there, and then just keep pushing on the doors until I knew something was opening up in front of me. And that's why this poem strikes me so much. Once I sang a song in Spanish for one of my friends from Guatemala, and I finished it, and he said, "Oh, Cipriani, it's beautiful. What language was that?" So, in case you understand Spanish or you don't, I'm going to tell you, caminante, non hay camino. It's beautiful in Spanish. Italian has this too. The words can go together. Caminante, caminar, camino. All the same word, walker, you know, traveler. But it doesn't work in English. Traveler, your footprints are the road, nothing else. Traveler, there's no road. Caminante, non hay camino. Si hace el camino al andar. You make the road by walking. You make the road by walking, and when you turn around, you will see the path that no one will ever step on again. Like our vocation journey is that individual is really much more existential. Something very existentialist about this, isn't there? Caminante, traveler. There's no path, only the wake in the sea, you know, that disappears as soon as the ship goes by. Caminante, non hay camino. Traveler, there's no path. You make the path by going. You just put one foot in front of the other. One of our monks is a kind of a professional caminista, I want to say. He's made the Camino 5 times and all the different routes. And he always talks about the Camino will teach you. The Camino will open it before. The Camino will show you what to do. So this is Antonio Machado, a poet whose poetry is rather popular now, too, from like the early part of the 20th century during the Spanish Civil War. Roughly contemporary of Federico García Lorca.
Tus huellas, el camino es nada más. Caminante, no hay camino, el camino sigue hacia el andar. Al andarse hacia el camino, ya volver la vista atrás, se ve la senda que nunca llega de volver a pisar. Caminante, no hay camino, sino estrellas en el mar. Caminante, no hay camino, sigas y el camino al andar. Camino, ya volví la vista atrás, llevé la senda que nunca llega de volver a pisar. Caminante, no hay camino si no estés en el mar. Caminante, no hay camino, sigas el camino al andar. Sigas el camino al andar. Sigas el camino al andar.
So my first stop after Tassajara was I headed straight across the desert, and I kept telling people before, as I was heading into the sabbatical, I'm craving heat and solitude. I had spent 14 years living in Arizona, so something about the desert that was really, really calling me. I needed to be alone. I needed to be hot. And my first stop first major stop was in Snowmass, Colorado. There's a Trappist monastery there. The monks that I know pretty well, and I did some work for them, but they have a hermitage that's about 10,000 feet high in the Rockies, 4 miles from the monastery, surrounded by nothing but cows. Just beautiful. So I spent a week in solitude to get myself kind of cleansed out and ready for the road ahead. And one of the first things I did was set that poem to music, because it, having been brought up the week before, it was really calling to me about this idea of how our vocation just keeps unfolding. And the last night, I was actually getting kind of restless. I was supposed to leave on a Thursday, I believe it was. And I knew I had to clean the hermitage before I left. And I was just restless, restless, restless. And I had to, and this doesn't happen very often anymore, get up and write a song. And so I started working at it about 1:30 in the morning, and tried to go back to sleep, and then got up and started working on it again. And I'm working on it while I'm vacuuming the house and dusting all over the place. And by the time I left that morning, I had it pretty much, let's put it next to me in the car, and I was working on it as I was driving away from Snowmass out into New Mexico. The other line that was in my mind quite a bit, as this craving for the desert was with me, was this line from the second chapter of the prophet Hosea. I always say it's a favorite line of monks. It's a favorite line of mine, and I might be projecting that onto other monks. But God says to Hosea, through Hosea, I will lead her, speaking to Israel, into the desert, and there I will speak to her heart. I will lead her into the desert, and I will speak to her heart. Now, what's so beautiful about that to me is the contrasting images, and I use it to refer to the monastic cell. See, we come from the hermit tradition, so we each actually have a little house we live in all by ourselves. The temptation is to turn that into a bachelor pad in Big Sur, you know. We have wireless internet now. Gosh, you know, I could pad it up with my favorite magazines, my favorite snacks, you know, get a phone. But no, that cell is both a bridal chamber and a desert. It's both the place of purification and the place of love. That's the desert. And that somehow is the goal for me of the spiritual life, is to find that place that's both a place of purification and the place of love. Any of you who have ever loved will know that actually love is the place of purification. So I decided to, that was the line I had to sing. I will lead her, I will lead you into the desert. I had seen a TED talk with David Brooks, who's one of my all-time favorite writers. I follow everything he... Matter of fact, he's a friend of a friend, and I sent a message to him recently. You are the only voice I trust in America right now, I told him. You know. He had went through a very hard time in his life, went through a divorce. And then he gave a TED Talk. It's a magnificent thing, probably about a year ago, The Lies Our Culture Tells Us. It's just fantastic. And part of that talk, he's talking about his own breakthrough at the end of his period of spending some time in solitude and coming out of it. He says, then you go out into the wilderness alone. Now, the desert and the wilderness in the Bible are really the same thing. You go out into the wilderness alone. You go out to the place where there's nobody there to perform. Now, he doesn't say, I don't know if it's a grammatical error he made. He doesn't say nobody to perform to or nobody to perform. It's kind of ambivalent that way. There's no one to perform. And the ego has nothing to do. And it crumbles. And only then are you capable of being loved. Of being loved. I'm going to read that again. I think it's a brilliant nuanced paragraph. Go out into the wilderness alone. You go out to the place where there's no one there to perform, and the ego has nothing to do, and it crumbles. And only then are you capable of being loved. So between the scripture passage and this little passage of David Brooks, that reminds me, I need to somehow get this song to him, I think. The other line that came to my mind as I was finishing the song was Jesus asking the crowd after he's found out that John the Baptist is in prison, and John the Baptist sends Jesus the message. He turns back to the crowd and he said, what did you go out to the desert to see? Somebody dressed in fine silks? What did you go to the desert? What did you expect in the desert? Ease? Comfort? Desert with me and tenderly speak to your heart. No one to perform, no one to direct, no need to follow, no need to connect. No one to teach, cause there's nothing to learn. You've got nothing to lose and nothing to earn. Desert with me, and there let me speak to your heart. Let the sun burn away your every desire. There's still greater love even after the fire. If you can stand naked and poor without shame, you will rise up at the sound of your name. What did you go out to the desert to see? Did anything speak to your heart? I saw mountains in summer still covered with snow. I heard coyote howl for no reason I know. A thunderstorm passed at my level of sight, and dawn slipped in early through some crack in the night. A bee seemed to buzz flying straight through my head, and a bird sang vespers for me in my stead. Words flew on wings in the cool evening air. I spoke to you often as if you were there in a prayer. Will you go out into the desert with me? Thank you.
desert with me. I will lead you into the desert with me, into the desert with me, into the desert with me, into the desert with me.
Yeah, I think we're going to meet someday. Okay, we have two, actually we have two mutual friends. And so, yeah. There's another song I wanted to say. These are, you are my guinea pigs tonight. Because these are songs I don't, most of these are things I have not performed in front of people before. I shouldn't have told you that. You know what I'm saying? I wanted to tell you the story about that one, the Antonio Machado song. When I was in Italy, at our mother house in Camaldoli, which is near Arezzo in Tuscany. And the prior general, as usual, asked me to sing for something. And it was a blistering hot day in this upper salon. And I was supposed to sing something at the beginning and something at the end of this poetry reading. And I decided I was going to do this poem of Antonio Machado, which I had never performed anywhere before. And it's in Spanish, and they're Italians. So I'm trying to translate the Spanish into English and then into Italian in front of a group of total strangers. And I had just written the song. It was a disaster. I've had very few disasters in my performing career. It was a total disaster. It was as if I was just trying to play the guitar, and I don't know if anything came out in any language at all. this is another song that was written on the road. In 2011, I was able to go to the Holy Land. And the year before, I had been in Lebanon and Syria. As I mentioned, I did a lot of work in interreligious dialogue. There's a wonderful phrase a Muslim friend of mine taught me, who does a lot of work in interreligious dialogue in Singapore, actually works for the government of Singapore, the narcissism of minor differences. Isn't that beautiful? And sometimes it's the people you're closest to that you disagree with the most. So it was pretty easy to dialogue with Hindus and Buddhists and people who were studying yoga and studying Vipassana, and we just sip green tea and talk about our yoga practice. But when you go to the Mideast and you're talking with Jews, Christians, and Muslims, it's life or death. It's a whole different conversation going on there. And the year before, I had been in Lebanon and in Syria, sponsored by a Danish group called Dan Mission that does work in interreligious dialogue. And they wanted me to do a series of concerts called Dialogue Through Music. And I'll tell you what, I never felt tension like I felt there. And this is before the civil war broke out in Syria, but the tension was already there. And Lebanon has had just one thing after another. I was interviewed by the newspaper in Beirut at the beginning of the thing, and they said, "What is your message?" And I said, "I've come here to learn," because I really felt like I knew. I was such a stranger in a strange land when I was there. "I've come here to learn about Lebanon. I've come here to learn about Syria. And if I could, talk something about what we have in common." But this is not a facile conversation when you're in a place where the cultures are really clashing against each other. One day we were in just outside of Damascus, visiting with a very famous Sufi, a very well-known Sufi master who had just come out of prison. Bashar al-Assad had put him in prison for 15 months for doing some dialogue work. And in the middle of his conversation, he started pointing there and saying in Arabic, it was being translated for us, "And that's ours." What he was pointing to was the Golan Heights. And I realized we were just on the other side of Israel at that point. The next year, I find myself in the Sea of Galilee. And our tour guide points out, "And those are the Golan Heights." And I'm like, "Oh my goodness, last year I was on the other side." And really that these have been contested areas for thousands of years. I mean, probably the Roman soldiers were marching over the top of them when Jesus was standing there. Too. Just amazing to be in a place like that. And to realize we know nothing about what's going on over there. Just nothing. just nothing. We're total strangers, unless we can really absorb that in our bones. And I found that Christians are especially in a privileged position in that area, because we stand between these two religions and could be a bridge. And quite often, I think the Christians do form that as well. I think many people don't realize how many Christians are in the occupied lands in Palestine, are suffering as much as the Muslim brothers and sisters are there. So I arrived in Tel Aviv at 2:00 in the morning, and I knew I was going to be arriving in Tel Aviv at 2 a.m. And I wrote to a friend of mine. I said, "I'm arriving at 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv. What the heck am I going to do at 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv?" And he said, "That sounds like it'd be a good song." I said, "Oh my goodness, I think you're right." And on my way, I stopped by, on my way to there, I made 3 stops on the way to Israel. One was in Chicago with a friend of mine who's a wonderful singer-songwriter. And I told him, "I got this idea for a song called 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv." And he's a fantastic lyricist. And he said to me, "If you don't put the line in, I still believe in Tel Aviv, I'll never speak to you again." So I had to add an extra verse in just for him. Do you know what El Miraj is? Okay, Muhammad's night flight. And you know what the Hajj is? Okay, so then I have to explain this song to you, yeah. I'm just going to sing it for you. I'm not going to explain it anymore. But I wrote this entire thing on my cell phone. The whole lyric, which is quite fun to do it, sitting in the airport at 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv. Because I wanted to arrive in Jerusalem as the sun was coming up. So I waited till the shuttle to about 5 to come up the hills as the sun was coming up. So I'm sitting there, and this is kind of what's going on around me. I've flown in from the west. I'm anxious to get started, but I need to get some rest. The fervor that I feel like a fire in my bones, a love for the journey and a longing for my home. I'm a poet with a passport, I'm a pilgrim on his Hajj, tumbling through the night toward the light of my mirage. Smugglers and troubadours are always on the run, 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv, waiting for the sun. Darkness all around me, but it's holy and it's warm. They tell me God is hidden here behind all name and form. Will the grave proclaim your love? Will the shadows sing in praise? And will I one day gaze on the beloved face to face? I'm a poet with a passport, I'm a pilgrim on his Hajj, tumbling through the night toward the light of my mirage. I never know what's next, I guess I'm just like everyone, at 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv, waiting for the sun. There's no one here who knows me well, I'm truly on my own. I've come to know the difference between lonely and alone. I've fumbled and I've stumbled, for the way's been never clear. Landed on my own 2 feet, I still wish you were here. I'm a poet with a passport, I'm a pilgrim on his Hajj, tumbling through the night toward the light on my mirage.
There are families all around me with their children having fun at 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv, waiting for the sun. I thought that we could change the world with just a little song. The things we hold in common are the things for which we long. Hope's a seed that never dies in spite of all the pain. And I still believe in Tel Aviv, my life's not been in vain. I'm a poet with a passport, I'm a pilgrim on his Hajj, stumbling through the night toward the light on my mirage. I guess I'll keep on running now until the race is run. 2 a.m. in Tel Aviv, waiting for the sun. Waiting for the sun.
I tell you, the second time I've sung that song, outside of my room. What occurs to me, having been, I talk about this little fish reel, reeled back to the community to be bumped upstairs, my own discernment about my vocation was the most subtle one I've ever gone through. My spiritual director is a Jesuit. And the Jesuits talk about not just the good, but the greatest good. Summum bonum. What's the greatest good you can do? So I didn't have to go back to the monastery. It really was up to me. I didn't have to take the position as prior. It was up to me. And I kept asking myself, what's the greatest good I could do with my life now? And that is a very subtle question. Very subtle question. And how that ties into our theme here, you'll know some of this. There's some benefits to getting older, the wisdom we get. I think that what we would call in Catholic was just like the eschatological sign of the wanderer is really a valid, important prophetic image. Because the wanderer is the one who lives in simplicity and who really is a solitary, especially in the Eastern Christian tradition. Wandering is actually a form of the eremitical life. How many hours I spent in airports, on airplanes, on buses, on trains, with people I had never met before, feeling so lonely. And that's part of that you hear in that song. There's a real solitude, there's a real asceticism about wandering. And I'd be on the road sometimes for 9 weeks with just what I had in my backpack. That's living simple. And as hard as it was, it was a wonderful adventure for me. So I thought that was a really important eschatological sign and still perdures to this day. The sign is really needed as the climate changes, as we have this health crisis, as whatever could happen coming up in the future if the economic system fails, if the political system fails. The sign of the wanderer, the sign of the renunciate, like a John the Baptist in the desert, I think is going to continue to be very important. And the other thing that's important is building something new. Sinking those deep roots in a piece of earth and trying to live a different way. And with that in mind, I recommitted myself to my community in Big Sur. Say, okay, we've got some years to try this whole darn thing a different way. Let's find a different way to live on the planet. More gently on the planet. More gently with each other. Let's build a place of welcome where people don't feel like they have to punch a time card or check off an ideological ticket to walk in the door. Let's see if we could do this whole darn thing a different way. And I think both of those things are going to be really important as we move forward. Both that sign of the renunciate, the sign of the wandering monk, let's say, the sign of the pilgrim, and those who are ready to build something new if the whole darn thing falls apart. Those are going to be the ones everybody else will be looking to. And I tell our brothers sometimes, if the whole darn thing collapses, everybody else is going to be looking to Esalen or to Tassajara or to Mount Madonna, these communities who have learned a whole different way to live gently on the earth and a whole different way of communication, saying, what are you guys doing right that we didn't get yet? Our friends at Esalen call themselves the Pagan Monastery. And as I told somebody, we actually have a really good relationship with them. And I say that with all due respect. And at any given moment, there are more Christians and more Catholics at Esalen than there are at Newcomb Elderly, you know, I think. And our friend, Brother David Steinerath, lived there for a time, and I've done lots of work there as well. And what I also tell the brothers is, those pagans, and I say this again with affection, are way ahead of us in so many things. Why are we catching up on the environmental issues, we Christians? They're way ahead of us in dialogue. They're way ahead of us in the inner work that we're just beginning to learn. They're way ahead of us in figuring out how to eat right, how to take care of their bodies. We, the most incarnate of all religions, way ahead of us on that. So this idea of incarnating, I think, is really, really important for us going forward. With that in mind, the next song I wanted to sing for you, and I think I've talked so much, I'm almost near the end of my time here, aren't I? Let's choose carefully. This song is called... I'm going to tell you to do this one for you. It's called Loving Kindness. I had the great good fortune of going to Indonesia in 2009, and I was sponsored there by a World Community for Christian Meditation, and I got to know somebody there. I actually made a friend there, which was kind of interesting, because usually when you're a visiting celebrity, and I say that with scare quotes around it, you know, you never get a bad meal, and nobody ever tells you the whole story. But this one guy, as everybody was wandering around trying to feed me the best food they could possibly feed me, come up to me, sat right in front of me across from me at the table, and said, "So, you're a guitar player? I'm a guitar player too." And we became pretty fast friends. And the last night I was in Jakarta, he took me out for a real Indonesian meal. You may not know this, but Indonesia is the largest population of Muslims on the planet, this island nation. You might think of it more as the Mideast, but it's there. But it's also a huge population of Chinese people. So it's this great mixture of cultures, Indian, Chinese, Buddhist, Muslim, Christian, Dutch. The Dutch colonials were there as well. So he takes me to this restaurant. It's called Baba. And we walk in, and literally, my jaw dropped open. One of the things I remember about Jakarta, the outside of the city was not so impressive, but restaurants and hotels, the most beautiful interiors of any place I'd ever seen in the world. And this restaurant was no exception. These beautiful batiks hanging from the wall, great pots of incense, candles burning, statues of the Buddha all over the place. And the smells were amazing and the music playing. And I said, the man's name was Gunawan Lembono. I said, "Gunawan, what is this place?" And he said, "This is a Chinese Buddhist Indonesian restaurant." This never occurred to a little boy from Chicago to put those three things together. And of course, then I find out this huge population of Chinese that came down into Indonesia brought Buddhism with them. So here we were in a Chinese Buddhist Indonesian restaurant. And it was delicious food, by the way. So the next morning, I'm in the airplane. I'm flying to Australia. And as is my wont, I have bought CDs of and MP3s of music of Indonesia. And one of the things Indonesia is known for is gamelan music. And gamelan music is usually made at these orchestras of metallophones, of metallic instruments, gongs and xylophone type things. But another part of Indonesia, Sudan, I believe it's called, there's a kind of gamelan music. It's very simple, and the recording I had was just a drum, one metallophone, and a flute. It's just beautiful. I'm listening to it in my earphones on the airplane, and this one piece goes by where I absolutely have to sing this melody. It doesn't have words. It's just the flute playing. So I reach into my bag, and the first book I pull out was Jack Kornfield's collection called The Teachings of the Buddha. And I open up to this very selection, and it worked. And I put these words to this Chinese Buddhist Indonesian melody. There's a concept in Buddhism that I love very much. We use it sometimes in our translations of scripture to a compound word, loving kindness. Loving kindness. And what we find out along the way is that, as Thich Nhat Hanh would say, there's no way to peace. Peace is the way. And I quite often preach about the fruits of the Spirit. And each of those fruits is actually also an action. There's no way to gentleness. Gentleness is the way to gentleness. There's no way to patience. And for God's sake, don't ever pray for patience. That's why you get his trials. You get to practice it. Patience is an action. It's not a feeling. And the same thing with kindness. It's an action. It's something we choose to do. And these two are their own paths. So the Buddhist tradition talks about loving kindness that way. And the way I understand it from the Buddhist teaching is when we practice loving kindness bursts forth inside of us. And I wonder if it could be said about all these virtues. When we practice patience, suddenly patience bursts, opens up from inside of us. When we practice peacemaking, suddenly that interior peace opens up inside of us. And I sometimes teach our young monks the same thing. The Buddhists say, before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. There's also a New Yorker cartoon that had this whole series of the guru and disciple. And the guru is turning to the disciple and he says, what do you mean, what's next? This is it. This is all we do. So a really holy monk is doing the same thing that a novice is doing, because the way there is actually a reflection of the goal itself. Caminante non hay camino. Se hacia el camino al andar. So this one you could sing along with me. It's a little awkward. I forced the English words to go on an Indonesian melody. You should just sing, it glows, it shines, it blazes up. Can you say that? It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It's a little high. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. 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 And then so loving kindness. So loving kindness when it comes. So loving kindness when it comes. So it glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness when it comes. And then I'll do the rest of it again. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness when it comes. Now, mind you, this song is written for three instruments, and I'm trying to pull all of it off on one little instrument here. So if my fingers get tangled off and I fall off a stool and turn blue, you'll know why. But any of those who've raised in the 1970s rock and roll will appreciate when I say everything I learned in rock and roll comes in handy in this song. It's Buddhist by way of the Scorpions. Thank you.
when the moon begins a-glowing, slowly absorbing all the stars. So loving kindness, when it's glowing, will bring its freedom to the heart. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness, when it comes, slowly absorbing all the stars. Again, it glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness, when it comes, will bring its freedom to the heart. Shining into a clear and cloudless sky. So loving kindness, when it's shining, will bring its freedom to the heart. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness, when it comes into a clear and cloudless sky. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness, when it comes, will bring its freedom to the heart. Chasing the shadows from the dark. So loving kindness, when it's rising, will bring its freedom to the heart. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness, when it comes, chasing the shadows from the dark. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. It glows, it shines, it blazes up. So loving kindness, when it comes, will bring its freedom to the heart. Slowly absorbing all the stars into a clear and cloudless sky, chasing the shadows from the dark, and bring its freedom to the heart.
I could leave some time for questions. Maybe I'll sing one more song at the very end. Then I'll tell you, I do have some books there if you'd like. The books are $25 because they also have a digital download free with them. And there's a DVD of us summer of 2018, a live concert with all my musician friends. It's kind of nice. And that's only $15 if you'd like. And there's $5 change in the backpack if you have 20s or something like that. Shameless hawking of wares. Any questions or comments, reflections? Please.
So the the rock star background?
Not rock star.
Musicality, lifestyle, perhaps?
Yeah.
And similarities between your life then and your life now? And second part of the question is, so what's home for you?
Oh, wow, what a great question. Thank you. Similarities, I would say, not so much about rock itself, but, I refer to myself as a professional musician throughout my 20s, which means I refuse to do anything that actually paid, for 11 years. But, I really was quite committed to music, meaning that I did any kind of music that came my way so that I could just do music for a living, including, playing bass in a polka band at one point, and, I did a lot of studio work and taught, and some of the finest musicians I knew were journeyman musicians like that. They were just out there working because they loved to make music, arrangers, composers, teachers. But I find that dedication to a craft like that, that's kind of single-minded dedication to a craft like that, has something very similar to the monastic life in that way. It could, to some extent, really affect the rest of your life around, in relationships and family and things like that, too. And there's also an intensity about it that burns a lot of people out, because there's a kind of a high to performing. Walker Percy has this great book called The Last Self-Help Book, Lost in the Cosmos, and he has the best explanation of this I ever heard. It's not necessarily before a performance that you'd want to get drunk or get high. It's after, because you can't come down, because you can't re-enter. Does that make sense? And I think all kind of performers would feel that way, maybe even visual artists. To re-enter from that altitude is really difficult, because you want to maintain that high. So that's like the dark side of something positive. The positive side, and I actually haven't thought of this before except in that line, that specifically in the monastic life, there's kind of a single-minded devotion to something. Raimundo Panikkar, the great author, would call it a blessed simplicity. The monk as this one example of this archetype of being dedicated to that one thing only. So I had a little apartment in Phoenix above a garage, and people used to call it my urban hermitage. I had such a solitary life. I spent so many hours at the piano doing arrangements and composing and practicing the guitar. So in that sense. And also I would have to say there's something also about that. It sounds pedestrian to call it that way, that high. I sometimes jokingly but affectionately refer to some of my young friends who are spiritual seekers as bliss junkies. And I think some people, especially in this day and age, come to the spiritual life looking for that high. And want to find a practice that's going to make them feel good. And there's a lot of danger in that. Because I think that leads us down some pretty slippery roads. Thomas Keating was a wonderful teacher of meditation. John Main, I think, would agree with this too. These great teachers of meditation would say, it's not about the high. It's not about the high at all. It's about that maintaining. That maintaining, it's much more a marathon than it is a sprint, the spiritual life. Yeah, and I think that we need the same kind of sobriety, I think, in monastic life that you need to be a successful artist in that way. That's kind of dancing around your question, but I hope I made some sense there. Yeah. Also, one other thing I find, the connection, the similarity between being a performer and being a priest, I also find very interesting. I never thought of myself as an entertainer, but a performer, which is a different thing, I think, in my mind. And I'm sure Amber could tell you this too. My understanding, a good presider at liturgy actually disappears. So it's not about Father Cyprian's Mass. It's not about come and see this rock star priest. It's really about me disappearing so that the spirit can shine through, so that the ritual can shine through, so that the tradition can shine through, so that the word can shine through, and I get out of the way. And I think the best performers are that way too, in any field. That is a chastity about it, I think, about good performance in that way.
I guess that's the achieving the super good.
That's the greatest good, yeah. Too, this is a T.S. Eliot line, something about art is not self-expression; it's actually the release from self. It's something like that. I can't quite get it right. What we're aiming at is not just express ourselves. Maybe get that out first, and then try to express the universal. Because as soon as we're expressing the universal, we're expressing the capital W word and wisdom. Which is the logos, which is the capital B beauty, the beauty that is God, if we can get out of the way. Yeah. It's obviously going to have our footprint, our fingerprint on it, and our specific voice on it too, but where we're ultimately trying to express, it'd be like a stained glass window where the light shines through, I think. Yeah. And the second question was, what's home?
Would you repeat that?
Oh, yeah. What is home?
Oh, what is home?
Yeah. Do you know, one of David White's things struck me so, so deeply. He wrote his poem about a friend of his who had a little plot of land in Ireland, and he said about the land that he finally found the place where he could die. He just wanted to stay the rest of his life. And the little cabin I had in Santa Cruz, I really wanted to stay there the rest of my life. I just loved that life. I loved that place. I loved the people that I was in community with there. And it was heartbreaking to leave there to go back to Big Sur for me. And at the beginning of this sabbatical, I went and visited for the first time in like 7 years that little cabin. And there was a big pink slip on the door of it that was condemned by the county. And I couldn't figure out why. So I walked around the outside. And you know, last year we've had these terrible landslides in Big Sur. I walked around the backside. There was a landslide in the back of the cabin. The backyard was a cliff. So I'm not going back there. It was like, I get the point, Lord. You know, it can't be just a place. It can't be just a place. The people there, you know, were really what made that place home for me too, to feel. I had such a quiet life, but I was surrounded by such love and such support. And we've talked sometimes just casually about would we ever have to move out of Big Sur because it would just be untenable because of the fragility of the land and the distance from the city and the guys getting older. And we love that place. And for monks, the place and our life are not two different things. We're, the Trappists call themselves lovers of the place. You know, we're really rooted there. But ultimately, I look around that room with my 12 brothers who I live there. I love these guys. I'll go anywhere where they are. And we'll build another life somewhere else if we have to. So, yeah, that's home for me. Home is where I belong to people, where we belong together. And that could be in Damascus, Syria, if the relationships are there. You know. Thank you. Anything else I can?
So, tell us a little bit about your book.
Okay. The book is 20. I wanted to put the sheet music out for 20 of these songs that I wrote during those periods of traveling and interreligious dialogue. And by the end of my time on the road, I was doing kind of what I did tonight, was like half talking and half singing, because people like the stories behind the songs so much. So when I started putting the songbook together, I started giving long explanations of the songs, and the explanations got longer and longer, and then I was putting in excerpts from my travelogues and photos, and it wound up being this really cool book, and my publisher, Oregon Catholic Press, took the risk on it. Mm-hmm. And I've actually never seen anything like it before. It also includes the digital download of it, so it's kind of fun to read. It tells the story about the traditions and also about, you know, where the songs came from. And then the DVD is a concert that I did with about 8 of my friends up in Holy Cross Church in Santa Cruz for my 60th birthday. You know, for my 60th birthday.
When you did that.
Yeah, they're wonderful, top-notch, world-class musicians. So, yeah, it's not me by myself with my guitar trying to do all the parts on one. You know? So, yeah, and the book is 25 and the DVD is 15. And I'm sorry I didn't bring any granola. What you really wanted was the granola. You didn't want the, you didn't want the music.
The fruit cakes.
I'm going to do one more song for you. It's another song that has a long story. Well, you the short version of it. This is a setting of the Buddhist Metta Sutta. The metta practice in Buddhism, as I understand it, goes like this. At the end of a period of meditation, you would dedicate whatever merit you might have gotten from the practice out. So first you wish that I would be well, that I'd be at peace, that I would be happy, that I'd be at peace. And then everybody in the room, that they would all be well, they'd be happy, they'd be at peace. Maybe all the creatures on this land, and farther out to the whole neighborhood, maybe to the whole state, and then across the whole country. You keep extending that circle of compassion out, dedicating whatever merit you might have gotten to somebody else. This was set to music by a friend of mine who's a Chinese Buddhist monk, also a guitar player named Heng Shua, and he used the music of the Canadian singer Lorena McKennitt from her setting of a poem of St. John of the Cross, which is a very cool thing. I mean, this is a Chinese Buddhist monk using a melody of a Canadian singer who's writing of a poem of St. John of the Cross and teaching it to a Christian monk. So this is the bridge we've been looking for. And I attached to the beginning of that a chant that I learned from India called the Mahamrityunjaya mantra, which is the great chant to conquer death. And when he taught me this, he said with a little twinkle in his eye that this was the Buddhist version of intercessory prayer. When you dedicate your merit out to somebody else. So I've actually used this, I've used this all over the world in a prayer service as the intercessory prayer at the end of the prayer service itself. I'm going to sing first for you the Sanskrit mantra that my brother and sister monks and nuns in India sing every day at midday, and then this the setting of the Buddhist Metta Sutta called Compassionate and Wise. And perhaps too you could think of some person, place, or thing that we could dedicate our merit to tonight, whatever good we might have gained from being together, to people who are suffering, the millions of refugees in North India right now, all those who are lonely and scared because of being sequestered from the virus, especially the vulnerable elderly and poor. Pray for those who are stranded in places they don't want to be. One of our longtime resident oblates died just today at the Hermitage and was taken away. So for the repose of his soul and for all those who mourn, anybody else you think we should be dedicating our merit to tonight? Maybe you could call that out. Somebody we should be remembering.
Administration.
Anyone who's traveling.
Om Yam Jamahe Sugandhim Pushti Vardhanam Urvarakamiva Bandhanat Mrityor Mukshayam Amritat Om Sarvesham Svastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavantu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Shantu Niramaya Sarve Badrani Pushantu Maka Shuduka Bhagavave Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.